This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
This is AmTower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark AmTower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. AmTower Off-Center with your host, Mark AmTower.
Welcome to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. I have a special guest today, Dan Gordon, former OFPP administrator, former GAO guy, currently George Washington University Associate Dean for a while. And well, what the hell? Welcome, man. Thank you for coming.
I'm delighted to be here, Mark. Thanks for having me.
A lot of things to talk about. As Dan and I meandered in, we recorded this Friday before the show airs Monday, the 18th, something like that. We were hit with the news that protests are coming out of the woodwork for OS3, MRO, and OASIS. And we're not going to talk about those specifically, but we're going to talk about what leads up to this. But first, let's find out about Mr. Gordon. Tell us a little bit about your background, because you don't show up on my LinkedIn radar until like the early 90s. So there's a void there, man.
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, it took me a while to decide to go to law school. I didn't go to law school till I was in my early 30s. I often tell students at GW Law School that they don't need to feel as much pressure to move forward as they sometimes do. I think it's good for students to take a break, for example, between college and law school, though I'm not sure everybody needs to take a 10-year break, which is what I did. But then once I got out of law school and clerked, I sort of stumbled into procurement. I got to tell you, I often say that very few people, when they're 5 years old, say, "Mommy or Daddy, when I grow up, I want to work in federal procurement." It just doesn't happen. People
really?
Tend to, I know it's surprising, people tend to stumble into this field. Some of them race away from it as soon as they stumble in. But some of us, like you, like me, find it really, really interesting.
It's a fascinating area, but I guess there's some sort of element of missing brain cell somewhere that makes, you know, our synapses go another direction. But okay, so I didn't get my master's degree till I was 30, by the way. But my master's degree is not in business; it's in English, American Lit.
Also, a good thing to study.
I still read a lot of American Lit, so, and I'm really good in that category on Jeopardy. all right, so you did a 17-year stint at GAO?
I did, although actually the first thing I did after my clerkship was I worked at a very good law firm here in Washington, and that's where I got into government procurement, and that was a great training ground. It was a great place to learn how to work, do high-quality work, help clients think through what makes sense. One of the key lessons I got out of that period, and there were a good number, but one of the key lessons was companies usually don't protest. It costs money to protest. It's disruptive to protest. It may damage your relations with your customer.
Oh, yeah.
Companies are usually very reluctant to protest. I don't think people on the government side always realize how reluctant companies are to file protests. I know there are outliers. There are a few companies that file a disproportionate number of protests. But for most real contractors, filing a bid protest is something they're not going to do happily.
Well, it'd be interesting to run some stats on the habitual protesters to see, you know, if they're appended to a vehicle, do they actually ever make any money from it?
Absolutely. But one thing we've done at GW Law School with the help of our students is run some stats to see what percentage of federal procurements get protested. And in fact, more than 99% of federal procurements don't get protested. What you see protested is something like 0.4%, 0.5%. Now, it's true. You tell me you got a procurement for $100 million, obviously the odds are different. You're much more likely to get a protest. You tell me you've got a multiple award IDIQ contract that's worth billions down the road, and this is their only chance to get onto that contract, they're more likely to protest.
Well, that could account for OS3, MRO, and Oasis. And,
indeed.
I'm hoping that Joanne Wojtek over at Soup avoids this particular syndrome, but, you know, because she writes a tight contract.
She certainly does.
So you started at, what was the law firm?
Fried, Frank, Harris, Schreiber, and Jacobson.
Okay. Did we share any mentors? Lynn Bateman was my primary mentor in this part. Did you know Lynn?
I know the name, but I've never I didn't have the pleasure of working with Lynn. I will tell you that my original mentor was the late Paul Schnitzer, the wonderful, wonderful guy who actually came out of GAO and headed the bid protest section. So in a sense, he was my predecessor in that work at GAO. But I had other wonderful mentors, Joel Feitelman and Jim McCullough. Jim is still at Fried Frank doing very good work.
I still hear the name. So let's talk a little bit about the GAO, not specifically what you did, but the scope, because a lot of people don't understand that GAO is not a federal executive branch organization. It's a congressional organization, and it has a certain scope of work that it does that impacts the entire government market. So give us your 50,000-foot view, and then I'll ask maybe a couple of specifics.
You bet. GAO, as you said, works for Congress. And I can say, quite frankly, since I'm no longer at GAO, that GAO has to walk a fine line. It's not so easy because, on the one hand, Congress is their boss. Congress appropriates their funds. They're reporting to Congress. They're testifying in front of Congress. And yet, I don't want to shock any of your listeners, Congress is a very partisan organization.
You're going to love my new book.
It's shocking, ain't it? When members of Congress and committees request work from GAO, they're usually not doing it from some ivory tower point of view. They're doing it because they think that the answers are going to let them slam the administration if they're on the Republican side, or slam the opposition if they're on the Democratic side. And yet GAO, in between, sort of caught between those pressures, GAO is trying to be independent and nonpartisan. I think it can be a challenge. I think GAO does an extraordinarily good job, but people on the outside don't always realize how tough a challenge that can be.
It's hard being objective when there's that kind of pressure on you. But the vast majority of GAO reports that I've read, and I'm a pretty contentious guy, the vast majority of GAO reports that I have read are very even-handed.
They are. GAO sticks very close to the facts. It sometimes makes their reports unexciting reading, and people are sometimes disappointed, but GAO is going to stick close to the facts. It's not going to jump to conclusion. It's not going to make all sorts of inferences, and that can disappoint people. But I think it's the safe thing and the smart thing for GAO to be doing.
Well, one of the other things that that popped up this morning, and I apologize because it's actually a couple of weeks old now, we found a report that GAO did saying GSA doesn't measure agencies' inclusions of small business in strategic sourcing. Now, this has been, you know, bandied about in public all over LinkedIn. A lot of the news organizations picked it up, but this is a GAO report. So, what's your thought here?
Well, it's good that GAO looked into it. We can talk a lot about that issue if you want. The fact is that in office supplies in particular, because I think that's really what the concern grew out of. You bet.
Yeah.
Office supplies were often provided to the government by small businesses around the country. There were hundreds of small businesses that were selling office supplies to the federal government.
550 plus on 75.
And it's a good thing. And those hundreds of companies, most of them are still selling office supplies to the federal government. But the strategic sourcing effort that I was very involved in working on when I worked in the Office of Management and Budget, that effort wanted to push the use of a limited number of blanket purchase agreements, BPAs. So there were 15 of them. But those 15 BPAs that were put in place when I was there, we worked with GSA, we worked with the Small Business Administration to be sure small business interests were protected. 13 of the 15 BPAs went to small businesses, and it wasn't just, oh, you get a BPA, but maybe you don't get any work. We used to get weekly reports. I got a weekly report showing me the percentage of the dollars that were going to the small businesses, and those percentages were high. They were above 70%. It's actually better than what we used to have, but the problem is we used to have all this leakage. People would walk down the street and buy their office supplies on a purchase card from a big company, and no one paid attention. We paid attention. It was it changed the world because GSA became more focused on data, and they got access to data. Having data makes all the difference in the world. Otherwise, you're flying blind.
Yep. We're going to take our first break. I'm here with Dan Gordon today, former administrator of the Office of Federal Procurement Policy, currently Associate Dean of Law at George Washington University. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio. Back after these. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm here with Dan Gordon. I'll tell you up front, Dan's going to semi-retire this summer, so a la Larry Allen, he may feel less constrained now than ever before, but let's stick with a GAO gig here. Strengths and weaknesses in terms of its dealing with the acquisition arena, because GAO does a lot here.
Absolutely, Mark. Two main areas. One is the bid protest world. The other is the audit world. They're really very separate. They're separate organizationally. They're separate in their goals. They're separate in their impact. I think, and here I guess I'm biased because I'm sort of a product of the bid protest world at GAO. Mm-hmm. But I think that the bid protests serve an incredibly important function in terms of transparency, in terms of holding the government accountable, in terms of letting a company get their day in court in the sense of being heard and have their complaint listened to. I think it's incredibly important. People sometimes forget that GAO, though, in the bid protest shop, it's part of the Office of General Counsel. They're not looking to see if Company A is better than Company B. They're not looking to see which proposal is better written, which company is going to perform better. They're looking to see if the contracting agency followed the law. Following the law is all they're focused on. Mm-hmm. They're a legal shop. But what they do is incredibly important. Let me just mention in passing, we can come back to it if we have time, that I think that relations between GAO and the Court of Federal Claims, the other place that hears bid protests, it's important that those relations be good. And I invested a lot of effort when I was in GAO in being sure that there wasn't friction between the two. It doesn't mean there couldn't be disagreements. There's nothing wrong with disagreements. But I didn't want there to be bad blood. And I think it's fair to say that relations are good between the two forums on a personal level and an institutional level, even if the court and the judges sometimes disagree with GAO. Nothing wrong with disagreeing.
No.
On the audit side, what GAO is doing is very different. Because while bid protests are looking at one procurement at a time, they're never looking at systems on the bid protest side. On the audit side, they're virtually never looking at individual procurements except for some very large ones. Normally, what they're looking at on the audit side is overall, how is the system performing? Overall, are we working efficiently, effectively? That's why, for example, they were looking at overall, what's the impact on small businesses of strategic sourcing? It's a classic example. I think that is that overall, that systemic approach can be very helpful as long as people recognize that there are limits to it. Because when you're doing a systemic approach, you're not speaking to individual procurements, and people tend to jump back and forth depending what their interest is. They may be more interested in individual procurements, and GAO on the audit side is very rarely saying what happened in this individual case was good or bad.
Mm-hmm. So... Rule of law is absolutely key there.
If I could add one other point.
Yeah, please.
On the audit side, it is worth remembering, and it's relevant to this strategic sourcing report, it's worth remembering that GAO is focused on performance measures. GAO is focused on transparency. GAO is focused on accountability and competition. All those things are incredibly important to our system. But GAO is focused somewhat less on, is the government getting good prices? Is the final product working well for the government? they're just not focused as much on, is the procurement system delivering goods and services at good prices? Also a very important goal.
Right.
But it's understandable. They're an accountability organization. They're focused on accountability. I got to say that we can sometimes say, oh, we need more audits and more audits and more audits, and forget that, hey, the procurement system wasn't created to be audited. The procurement system was created to buy goods and services that the government needs, good prices, good quality. We need the audits. We need the accountability. Yeah. But we also need to be buying things at good prices, at good quality.
Yeah, but the time that GAO might step into a bad quality product situation would be if an agency was buying stuff that wasn't technically acceptable when you apply the LPTA rule. If somebody in Congress said, hey, they're buying schlock, why are they buying schlock?
Boy, you rarely see that. The only time you're going to see GAO say, and I don't think they often use the word schlock in their published reports.
Isn't that a technical term?
The only time you're going to see them talking about the quality of what's being purchased, I suspect, is when they're talking about a major weapon system or maybe a major IT system. If what they're talking about is just run-of-the-mill equipment, office supplies,
faulty
IT
pencils.
Equipment, yeah, you're not going to see GAO writing about that, even though that really, really matters to our buyers.
Well, it does matter to the buyers, and we'll get there. Let's talk about your migration then from GAO after almost two decades to OMB. So you jump from the top of the congressional food chain, if you civilian side of the congressional food chain, to the top of the executive branch food chain. OFPP's got a lot of weight.
I appreciate the point, although I never felt like I was at the top of any food chain. I was always keenly aware, and I think it's good for us to be keenly aware, that we were in a support function. We were in an outside function. That was true when I was at GAO, and in a sense, that was true in OFPP as well. OFPP, and I should point out, I think many of your listeners may know, those who know me, it was a very unexpected move for me. I was not looking to get out of GAO. GAO is an extraordinary place to work, and in particular, its Office of General Counsel was a great place to work.
You get a lot of reward, emotional.
You see it in the results of the surveys of best places to work. GAO consistently ranks very high. And the atmosphere within the office is an atmosphere of people dedicated to really helping the government do a better job.
And I have to imagine OMB is somewhat more politically charged.
OMB is in a tough situation. It's a much tougher place to work. You're constantly under unreasonable time pressures and demands from 20 different sides. The Office of Federal Procurement Policy, though, that position of the being the administrator was such an honor that I couldn't say, no, I won't be considered for that.
Well, you know, we've talked off air. I have two favorite people who've occupied that office. One of my favorite people in the government, Mark D. Lee, is one. You are the other.
You're very kind.
Well, outside of that, I'm not a big fan of a lot of people who have sat in that chair. And we'll not go into the reasons on air, but maybe during our personal breaks, I'll share a couple of things. But be that as it may, give us the scope of OF. No, before we do the scope of OFPP, you were on the job day one, right? So what happened day one?
Well, there's one little story, if you permit, I've got to mention, because it may amuse your listeners, but it also is, I think, representative of what I was trying to do. And this does, to be fair, it dates to my GAO days as well. I always believed in outreach. When I worked at GAO, I set up public sessions that were called Ask GAO, just to let people, whether they were companies or agency folks, come and say, why do you do this? How do you do this? Explain what you did. I used to remind people that it was Ask GAO, not Yell at GAO, but that's a different question. Well, when I started in OMB, I was obviously going to do the same thing, except that in a sense, the stakeholders were even more in number and even more important. So the very first day, before actually we had the system set up so I could bring people into the White House complex, I spoke with Stan Soloway, who many of your listeners know, the president of the Professional Services Council, and we decided to meet on that very first day because I couldn't yet get him into the White House. I had no choice but to go across the street. So there was Stan Soloway and me sitting in the Caribou Coffee, having a good chat about some of the issues ahead. Reaching out to industry, just like reaching out to the Hill and reaching out to the contracting agencies, was a core activity what I was doing at OFP Pitt.
Okay, we're going to pick up on that after the break. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, back after this. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I am Mark AmTower, because nobody else wants to be. And my guest is Dan Gordon. He was lucky to get that job, because it's a cool job being Dan Gordon. So we're at OFPP now. You're at OFPP now. It was a surprise gig. What's the scope of activity here, and how big is your bat when you have this administrator position?
I'll tell you, Mark. On the one hand, it can look very grand, like you're looking at the entire federal procurement system and
school
policy
office,
for
I've
the whole
there.
Thing. On the other hand, it can feel like you're terribly weak. Not only institutionally, you're a small office within the Office of Management and Budget, but you're also a very small team. We never got more than 16 people when I was there. 16 very good people, but it's a very small office. The only way you can succeed is by working well with people. And the great thing about the folks in OFPP is they're very good at working with people. That means working with people across the White House complex. Means working with well with people across the agencies. It means working well with people in industry, and it means working with the Hill, although I wish I had been able to do more work with the Hill when I was there. The other challenge you have is there's just too much happening. There's sort of, as I sometimes call it, bombs bursting in air. There's constantly crises. And if you don't keep your eye on a very limited number of things you care about, nothing's going to get done on those things, and you'll spend your entire day dealing with crises. I walked in with a very short list of priorities, and I stuck with them all the way through, and I think we made some modest progress. My number one priority was very straightforward: defend the federal acquisition workforce. We did not have enough people. They did not have good enough training. They were feeling unsupported, overwhelmed. My first job was to be there for them. That meant that I was putting out regular emails called notes from the administrator that went out to hundreds and actually I think thousands of 1102s across the federal government. It meant that I spent a lot of my time going around to federal agencies listening. Did it all the time. Just like that first day with Stan Soloway, in my first few weeks, I was out there in the agencies listening.
Well, those 1102s have had issues since the report of the National Performance Review, and a lot of it just was outsourced, and the training went away, on and on. So, every time Larry Allen and I talk about this, the 1102 issue always comes up.
And the fact is, we made progress. We hired people. The numbers actually went up in 2010, 2011, and that was a good thing. We made some progress in training, although not enough. Let me just mention, we may or may not have time for it, but the second priority was to actually buy less, which actually wasn't mainly us. That was mainly the program people. So our third priority, which was very much us, was to buy smarter. That leads into things about the GSA, the federal supply schedule, strategic sourcing.
Okay. Strengths and weaknesses of the office. You had a limited number of things. You also did the Mythbusters, which was critical. Also, part of Mythbusters, still hasn't seemed to permeate that 1102s can talk to industry.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I keep hearing about agencies that are telling their contracting folks, don't talk to industry, don't meet with industry. Because it's not allowed. That's why we call it Mythbusters. There's this myth that something in the law, something in the FAR, tells people not to meet with industry. when you're thinking about a future procurement, there is absolutely nothing wrong with having one-on-one meetings with companies. There is nothing wrong. It'd be different if you were in the middle of the procurement, obviously. In the middle of a competition, you can't have casual one-on-one meetings. But when you're thinking about what to buy down the road, it's market research. It's not only permitted, it's required. You don't have to do market research in a room with everybody present. Industry day can be a fine thing to do, but it's no replacement for sitting and listening to individual companies and their what they can offer the government.
Okay. So how big of a bat really did you have? I mean, what do you think the influence of the office is? Does it get out to the field?
I think it does, although my Lord, it depends on people. It depends on individual relations. Let me give you an example. The Defense Procurement Acquisition Policy Shop, DPAP, over the Pentagon, if the people in sitting in OFPP have bad relations with DPAP, you're not going to be able to do anything. The fact is defense procurement is more than 65% of our procurement. Sometimes it's more than 70% of our procurement dollars.
Few bucks.
Yeah. I mean, I was very fortunate because not only the other people that I worked with in OFPP, but I personally had good relations with the folks over in DPAP, whether it was Shea Assad or Dick Jinman. And that makes a huge difference because we knew that we had partners across the river that were focused on the same things we were focused on. Mm-hmm. That means that you're able to do more because you're pushing in the same direction.
Yeah. Maybe that's why Dee Lee was pretty successful there, because that's where she came from.
You bet.
So she probably knew a few folks.
Lecturing at people is not helpful. Working with people can make a difference.
Lecturing at people, I have found, is a very, very poor way to do a speech as well. So I don't do that anymore. So we have the DPAP thing. Did you like your time at OFPP after GAO?
Yes, is a short answer, but it was very, very different. I mean, let me give you an example of one of the things that was just terrific. I had access to the White House mess. I was allowed to eat in the White House mess. And when I first came on board, I discovered that there were people in OFPP that had worked there for decades who had either never been to the White House mess or had been there once a million years ago. So I said to my assistant, I said to Louis Pappas was his name. I said to Louis, Louis, I need you as a high priority to set up lunches so that I can have lunch with every single person that works in OFPP in the White House mess. The fact is there are people that work an enormous amount and they don't often get that signal that someone appreciates what they're doing, that someone cares about what they're doing.
Sounds like a minor perk, but it's not.
Oh, it mattered enormously to the people.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you're not going to overpay them, at least stroke them.
And they're wonderful people. I enjoyed every moment of those lunches.
Cool. All right, let's migrate here a little bit to some other issues, if you will. Presidential memos seem to sort of spontaneously generate. So do they have impact? Does anybody pay attention outside of, you know, some special interest group that may have started it?
They can have an enormous impact. Let me give you an example of the most important one that I dealt with. But I'll tell you very quickly, it happened before I got on board. But on March 4th, 2009, barely 6 weeks after President Obama came into the White House, they issued a memorandum on federal contracting, which was really important. It talked about the road forward, and it was a road forward that I was very comfortable with, which affected my decision to be willing to be considered as a candidate for the job of administrator. Looking at the question of have we outsourced too much? What work is inherently governmental? Looking at the issue of too many sole source contracts? Looking at the question of whether competition is real? Looking at the question of whether the government is buying too much, paying too much? That memorandum from March 2009 had enormous impact.
I had tremendous amount of fun, and I don't know if it made your radar or not with that one phrase, inherently governmental. I said, you know, this sounds particularly Orwellian.
And it's interesting because I spent a lot of time working with my colleagues issuing a new policy letter about inherently governmental functions. And I know that there were people that were disappointed because they thought we were going to come out and say that all this stuff is inherently governmental and the government needs to swing that pendulum back and insource millions of jobs. And what we said wasn't that at all. What we said was there are some jobs that are inherently governmental. Being a judge, you can't contract that out. But the number of positions that are inherently governmental that had been improperly contracted out, fortunately, turned out to be fairly limited.
Okay. When we come back after the break, we're going to do some quick hits on some hot topics, reverse auctions, FSSI, LPTA, and more. So stay tuned. You're listening to Amtower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Amtower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I am Mark Amtower. My guest is Dan Gordon, former administrator of OFPP, currently the associate dean of law at GW. Tell me, you know, what's special about GW Law?
Yeah, I tell people, Mark, I left the White House to work at GW Law School. It's got to be fairly special. GW Law School, as many of your listeners know, has the only degree program in government procurement law in the United States and North America, for that matter. They have had a program in government contracts for more than 50 years, originally set up by Ralph Nash and the late John Sabinick. That program is an extraordinarily valuable institution. The fact is we have students that are coming doing their JD degree, so becoming lawyers and taking a few government contracts courses along the way. We have lawyers coming to do an LLM in government procurement law. And since last year, we have a new degree that we do with the business school. So it's technically a business school degree called the Master of Science in Government Contracts, MSGC.
Ooh, you got to take my selling to the government to that.
I got to tell you, it is a terrific program. We're getting lots of interest, lots of students coming into that. Just this past fall, when Professor Steve Schooner and Tom Papson and I were teaching Formation of Government Contracts, we had 84 students in the classroom. They were split about half were JD candidates, about 20, 25 or so were LLM students, and then about 22 or so were business school students. So non-lawyers studying government procurement law, and the interaction among the students, I thought, enriched the discussions. It was one of these win-win situations.
Very cool. All right, let's. We got some quick hits to do here. Give me your short deep dive on LPTA.
I think a lot about it. I'll give you a short one, and then we can see how deep we can go in limited time here. A low price technically acceptable can be a good way to buy. If the government can define its requirements so well that if you meet those requirements, all the government cares about is price. It is more likely to be the case in commodities, goods or service commodities. It could be true in other areas, but it depends on how well we can write the requirements. And a lot of times, we just don't know enough to write the requirements well. If we don't write the requirements well and you do it LPTA, what you're doing is madness. It's suicidal because you're going to be going for low price even though you're not really getting the quality that you need. Obviously, the more sophisticated what you're buying is, the less likely it is you're going to be able to write requirements so that LPTA makes sense. So if you're buying professional services, LPTA is probably foolish. You'd be smarter to set up a trade-off and do a trade-off. If what you're buying is office supplies, LPTA can be just fine.
FSSI. One of my least favorite things.
sorry. I think strategic sourcing is smart. I think it's a good thing. It needs to be done well. You need to be sensitive to the impact on small businesses. You need to be sensitive to the way this plays out. But you can save a lot of money. The federal government is not hundreds of small customers. The federal government's the biggest customer in the world, and it usually doesn't get prices that reflect how big a customer they are.
No, but the only way you really deserve the best prices is if you really narrow that field down. So that's going to squeeze small businesses in a way that they can't play, because they can never offer the best price because they don't have the buying power from the manufacturers themselves.
It's interesting. A member of Congress met with me and a couple of colleagues from GSA when I was working at OMB, and a very nice member of Congress. And he said to me, "Mr. Gordon, you're going to need to choose. You either favor small businesses or you favor low prices. You can't do both." And I said, "I'm sorry, sir. I respectfully disagree. The fact is, and this is where the data makes the difference, we track the data and we saw in office supplies, agencies were paying less than they were before for the same goods. And yet more of the dollars were going to small businesses. It's true that if you weren't one of the 13 small businesses on that office supply FSSI, it's true you might be getting less business. But those 13 small businesses were getting over 70% of the dollars. It was a terrific success for small businesses and for low prices.
For 13 small businesses.
You bet.
So, again, When you're dealing with 550 plus companies that were on 75, 530 didn't make the cut.
I absolutely accept that, so, but that's what happens in competitions. The government's role is not to spend money so every company in the United States can get part of the pie. The government's role is to buy smarter.
Well, for a long time, GSA was touting the ability that this is the small business gateway to government sales. They pulled FSSI, OMB and GSA pulled FSSI without adequate notice to the business public, I think.
I can tell you that we met with the Small Business Administration. And we had rounds and rounds of meetings with businesses, large and small, before the solicitations went out on the street.
I'm not often a fan of SBA, but we don't need to go there. Let's migrate to next topic, reverse auctions.
I think electronic reverse auctions can be really, really smart. It's a little bit like LPTA in the sense that the more what you're buying is a commodity where all you care about is price, the more it makes sense to use an electronic reverse auction. If you were getting, you were going to hire a surgeon, I'd say use an electronic reverse auction only if you don't like the patient. If you like the patient, you're not going to want to go on price only. And using an electronic reverse auction, when you're going to try to do a trade-off with non-price factors, strikes me as crazy. I've heard about it. I'm profoundly skeptical. I think that electronic reverse auctions work best when you've got a field of acceptable bidders and all you're focused on is price. I will tell you, it's no secret that FedBid does the bulk of the government's electronic reverse auctions. GAO, as many of your listeners know, issued a report about electronic reverse auctions a few months ago. And if you look at the charts in that GAO report, GAO is always careful to show where their data's from. Mm-hmm. And most of those charts, the source of the data is FedBid. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, the federal government ought to be able to do, whether it's called reverse engineer or whatever, but the federal government ought to be able to do electronic reverse auctions without relying on a private company. But that depends on the federal government doing them intelligently and fairly.
Yeah, it depends on GSA stepping up to that particular
place. Right. I mean, frankly, I say it almost as a joke sometimes, but the GSA ought to be putting FedBid out of business. And I don't want to be unfair. FedBid does a very good job at what they're doing. But
debatable too. But
well, I'll leave that to another day. But the fact is that there ought to be a fair competition so that vendors, if you're sitting in the Department of Commerce, Department of Interior, and the Navy, you ought to say, will I get a better job? Will it be faster with better service and better prices if I use the GSA tool or a private company's tool? If in the end those bidders made a free choice and went for the GSA tool, I'd say terrific, but they shouldn't be forced to.
Okay. Last big question here. Are new procurement laws needed?
It's funny. When I was doing my confirmation hearing in front of the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, the issue came up. And in my view, we don't need new laws. We need to be focused on better implementation. In fact, as I was preparing for a House Armed Services Committee hearing a few weeks ago that got canceled because of one of these winter's repeated snowstorms, so that hearing hasn't happened. But in my statement, I was going to tell the committee that the best thing they can do by way of legislation is to spend time removing laws. I'm very pleased that Frank Kendall over in DOD is leading an effort to work with industry to find laws that need to be simplified, rewritten, or even repealed. That's more important and a higher priority than adding new laws.
Okay. Surprisingly, we still have time for one last question, and I want... you are in a particularly good spot for this one. Is it possible to do a sane, simple law for small contractors, set-asides, whatever? But there are more rules out there for small businesses doing business with the government than there is for anybody else. That's insane.
It is really challenging. It's not only insane, Mark, it causes problems. Because you end up with a system that is complicated. It's complicated for everybody. You lose transparency. You create this cottage industry of IG reports and GAO reports about companies that claim to be hub zone small businesses aren't really in the hub zone, that claim to be women-owned small businesses aren't really owned by women. On the other hand, is it a worthwhile goal to help our small businesses? Absolutely. I remember when I worked in the White House, I went to Fairbanks, Alaska at one point and learned firsthand about the benefits that the extra help we have for Alaska Native corporations, the benefit that that brings to Alaska villages. It really does help. But the problem is we don't have any good way to measure whether the benefits of all those small business programs outweigh the costs that they impose. I have never seen a reliable, good study that can give Congress a sense of, is it worth it? And without that, you're just guessing.
You are. Ladies and gentlemen, Dan Gordon. Dan, thank you so much for coming in today.
It is my pleasure.
Have a good time in talking to those people in France about procurement. and when you come back, let's do it again. You've been listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is not my day job. If you need help on the marketing side of the equation, or if your company needs to figure out how to leverage LinkedIn, give me a call. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net. And thank you very much for listening to AmTower Off-Center.
You've been listening to AmTower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off-Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.